All right. Good morning, Jacqueline. How are you this morning?
Very well, thank you, Lena. And yourself?
Yes, I'm really well as well. Thank you. Yeah, I would love for you to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you're doing and, as you mentioned before, how many hats you're wearing.
Thanks for that. It's very interesting when someone says introduce yourself because it's like, okay, where do I go to? So I'm just going to go there. Like yourself, I wear many hats. I was in the corporate world for about 20 years. Then I saw that, there was a call from the world basically when environmental issues started to arise. Like there was this need, and it was where was the best use of my energy? So I decided to step out of that world, and also because I had four young children and that needed to be my priority. But then I started to move into looking at the planet, and I didn't want to be a voice that just complained against everything. I thought, I want to find out what is the solution, what can I do? So that's when I discovered permaculture, and in 2011 I studied it and started practicing it since then. And I kind of basically started with permaculture. They talk about zones, and you start from your zone zero and you move out. And I basically started looking. I was already doing my own personal development work, and I'd been sitting in a woman's circle for a number of years, which kind of helped me get to this awareness. So then I started looking at, okay, what can I do in my own home? And I started changing things. I became vegetarian. Plastic was an issue. I planted a lot more fruit trees and started growing my own food. And then from there, I looked into my community, my street, and started to initiate projects that around food security in the inner city and managing our waste. So I started a transition town group. I built a food forest, a local food forest. I built some more community gardens. I was involved in setting up the compost hub at the town hall in Kensington. Then initiated another grant so we could set up another two and another one in the food forest. And then I built another garden up here on a patch of land that was really degraded and needed some attention. And then I've started to run my own woman's circles, and I've just started a healing practice around Reiki energy, intuitive healing work, which I facilitate people's healing. So those, I can't, and I'm not, I started a repair hub too. Those are the things that I come to mind. And so in any of that, I play either a role as a volunteer, an instigator, a disruptor, project manager, government relations, trying to get funding out of them to do those things, team leader. So there's various roles and that I play within all of those projects. But the main essence of it is to move forward to regenerate what is us in the inner city. Because when I found about permaculture, I thought, oh, I'm going to go buy some land, which I did, and made a mistake. And then I read this amazing series called the Anastasia, the Ring and Cedar series. And basically, there was a line in it which said, we can't all run to the forest. We need to clean up our mess where we're at. So I was living in the city and I thought, okay, I need to do something here. And that has taken me on a particular journey where I've learned a lot. I've come in contact with amazing people. Another part of the action in there is I've been like an activist, a lobbyist, a campaigner, particularly for the Venny Adventure Playground, which is where we met, I think, or Agnihotra, I can't remember. And the venue was under threat. The local council was going to put it out to tender and gave it to an organization that had not been part of our community and basically took it off the people who'd built up the venue and had this amazing essence of caring for the child and putting the child first. And our community said a big no to that. And so myself and a group of people got together and we formed this action group, and we basically campaigned to get it back into the hands of the people that had, who put the children first and were part of our community. And there was trust and relationship there, which the, just is worth more than the tender process and having, your compliance lined up. You know, the priority was in a different, the community felt the priority was this point, and the council thought this was the priority. And through that process, we were able to get back the venue into the hands of the people who managed it and had built that over many years. And it turns 40 years this year. So that was a great thing for our community. And that venue since then has played a critical role during COVID in supporting those in the flats, the Housing Commission, who haven't had a space to play, who've been under stress financially and with food. And it's been a great distribution point of support for all those things. And the community gardens and food forests that I've been involved in has provided significant fresh food to those people who couldn't get it because the supply chains were disrupted for those food banks and that during COVID. Until they got, because volunteers weren't able to participate. And there was a shortage of fresh food and members in our community need that. So we were able to activate very quickly locally and bring fresh food to those people. And I think at the end of 2020, there were like 90 families who would each week come and get fresh food that was grown locally in our gardens. So that took me on a tangent, but those are the kind of things that I do, you know, and I'm kind of moved by how I can be in service. And sometimes it takes me down that path and sometimes it takes me down that path. And so I'm learning to tune more into that higher wisdom, let's say, of being in service or acting out my Dharma. And I know that Dharma and your career can be two different things because I've explored that last year. I'm trying to now move in a flowing way where I'm not coming up against things too much, which is taking a lot of my energy. Because as I enter into the butterfly years, they say in Ayurvedic practice, my energy is moving in a different way. I'm becoming more into the ethereal and less in the material. And so as I'm moving into that eldership, there's a physiology change that happens, which means that I don't have that push as much into the world as when I'm younger. So I'm also, you know, and that whole menopause and premenopausal is all that shifting of that to, okay, where I'm now, I'm becoming aware of it and not fighting against it, but settling into it and operating in the world in a different way. So that's a long introduction, Lena.
I love the passion. Love it. I quickly wanted to get you to explain what actually the venue is for those people that live not in Kensington and don't know what the venue is. Maybe you can say a few words about this beautiful venue project.
The Venue Adventure Playground was set up by a woman 40 years ago. And she just set up this space in JJ Holland Park in Kensington as a backyard for all the Housing Commission kids. So she created this space where they could come and play and, you know, have space around them. And it's grown up into Adventure Playground, and there's, excuse me, a number of them around the world. And there were a number in Melbourne, but slowly we've lost a lot of those. So, and the council bulldozed her a few times, but she set up again, you know. And so the essence of it is a space for children to come play, to take risks. And the adults are there to play a guardianship role, but the kids get to play and use the space however they want. It's become, so it's a key, the key thing about it is that the children are playing. It's a place for them to play. What's happened from that is that it's become a sanctuary and a safe space, and the children, when they feel to reach to the venue workers, who are amazing people, very skilled in this area, of allowing the child its sovereignty, and instead of case managing them, allowing the child to reach out when they feel to. So this deep trust is built. This an acceptance of the child and however they are, whatever space they feel in, if they're angry, if they whatever, they can be that there. and they are contained. So if they're angry and they're acting out, they are allowed to be angry, but they're not, you know, they're held in terms of you can't hurt somebody else, or they talked about it, or, you know, it's not you can't do that, you this, you naughty, whatever the words are that the world kind of uses for children. So it's teaching the child. What I've witnessed is emotional intelligence, and I know if some of the Benny staff would actually talk, they'd use a different language and they would frame it much better than me. But basically, it's a safe space where kids can play, take risks, and learn to work through things that they might meet with other kids. It's a diverse group of people. My kids went to it, and it was great because they met kids from all over the world in all different experiences and different socioeconomics. And they form such a connection and awareness of difference and acceptance and tolerance and appreciation that has helped them throughout their world, you know, their high school and now into their careers. And it feels such a strong connection that children have with each other in the venue, because it holds that special place where they felt safe and were supported. And one of our young men in our community was 20, just died recently in a motorbike accident, and he had a great connection to the venue, and his family wanted a ceremony vigil held there, and all people came, and that's the kind of space that their venue holds for those young people. So they always connected to the venue, you know, and it, in different ways they come back, in different ways they seek sanction there, and some of them are now working there. And so it's just this, it's a feeling, it's a sense of belonging. It's
And we've created, it's a beautiful space.
Yeah, it's been there, yeah.
And I think it's important as well to give children this space. I mean, specifically when they live in commission housing in these tiny flats, to be outside, you know, but also to be connected to community. And yeah, just what you said before, just the importance also on, you know, just being a child, exploring, going to your boundaries and your, yeah, I just love this. I mean, I loved working with children, and it's so amazing. They're so smart little creatures. And I feel most parents fear them a bit too much, you know, like I think they're really great, capable little creatures. So I really love that this is created, this space.
Yeah. And then what we also, you know, my particular role in the venue, apart from lobbying for them and raising funds over years, and, you know, we do a Christmas gift thing for them, but my thing was about, you know, the environment they're around, to support them, to provide nutrient-rich food. So that's when I started getting involved in growing food there, and without chemicals, and following the season and harvesting our own seeds and planting those seeds. And I think we've planted in, I think there's about, I think 20 maybe fruit trees now at the venue. So the children are able to connect more with nature. It was really about them starting to see the seasons, where the leaves change color, when this fruit appears and then when that fruit appears, and them sampling the fruit, you know, because many of them wouldn't have known what a mulberry was or where orange tree comes from, because we've become so disconnected. And sometimes when you're a refugee, or you're a which they are there, you've been in camps for many years as a family, with your family, where you haven't been able to see a fruit tree grow. Stuff gets delivered off boxes on trucks and you scramble for that, you know? So that experience of watching a tree grow and then the fruit, and you're picking that, you know, and oh, I'm picking it now, but it's not ripe, and, you know, that whole learning and interaction and engagement with nature, some just did not have that experience. So the venue, with the food component we've put in the fruit trees, there's a different learning and observation going on, and connection and engagement with the fruit and the tree. And the, you know, the cherries come and the cherries are beautiful and they pick them and eat them. The mulberries come, then they see the citrus, and, you know, and the mums and that come down and they pick the veggies, and the kids dig for the potatoes. So that is also going on. That is another component that has been introduced, where the children explore with that. And some kids now plant their own seeds. They planted some sunflowers, I noticed the other day, and, you know, that's going to go in. So that connection back to nature is a really good grounding for a lot of kids in those spaces who haven't got that, because that connection to nature is our true nature of being humane, of being humanity. And when we care for a tree and we see it grown from seed, we'll think twice, maybe three times before we just chop it down. We have a different relation to it. You know, we have a different appreciation. And hopefully that is one of the fundamental reasons about trying to connect children back, so that when they're connected at a young age, it stays with them. They remember that cherry. They remember, you know, that fruit that they saw. They remember they planted that seed and what happened. And hopefully in some level, then their decisions will be different about our world around us.
Yeah, definitely so important to connect back to nature. And I think you did a wonderful job there with this planting boxes and different vegetables. And I think they're cooking them there too when they have lunch or dinner there, which I think is also great, from seed to actually harvest and then eating it, and tastes so much better anyway. Tell me a bit about the food forest. Like, what is a food forest?
Yes, that was something I learned in the permaculture. And what I realized, like in a city, when I started to look at things, I started thinking, okay, one of the problems we have is in inner city growing your own food is space. And also most of what has been created by organizations has been locked community gardens, locked behind a fence, and you've got to go there because everyone's afraid that people are going to steal. And I know that that does happen in community gardens, that there is theft of produce and taking maybe when someone feels they shouldn't be taking. So it was also about how to really change. It was a grass patch. And it was about how do we bring in biodiversity? How do we regenerate the soil? How do we create food? How do we create habitat? How do we bring this to life? And a food forest was a technology or technique that's used a lot by permacultures, and even longer, forest gardening. It's not unique to permaculture, and it didn't start there. It's been happening for years. But it was a technique that they unpacked, and they looked at how a forest worked. And they decided there's like seven layers in a forest, and now I think there's more, and that each layer has a particular role, because no one goes into a forest and has to prune or weed or fertilize or chop. It was just a system that happened by itself, and it stabilized. So the forest was a system that they thought, this is something that is stable, it offers all these benefits. How do we reproduce that and put food into it, food species into it, into the seven layers? So that's kind of my very basic, and I know there's people out there would have much more scientific explanations of the architecture of a food forest, but that's just a quick layman's terms of what a food forest does. So I thought that would be the best technology to apply to this space of grass, because it doesn't need much maintenance. It was very important for me that it wasn't locked off. So instead of having a number of raised beds where people could manage, it was going to be a forest which would people could walk through, harvest, pick from, that would evolve itself, that we would actually watch and evolve how nature took over. But we would give kind of like this boosting start of having these seven different layers in, worked on the soil, and then let's see what happens. So we established that in 2019. And when I say we, I worked with a woman by the name of Deb Wilson at Unison Housing. So that's the Kensington estate, and Deb is community engagement there and has done a lot of great community engagement projects, and we worked on it. It took us 18 months for the state government of Victoria to say yes to that land, and then because we got a community grant through the city of Melbourne, which was great, and that allowed us, we got 20,000, and that allowed us to establish the food forest. And then we put together a forest care team of volunteers who would help care for the team, for the forest. And it's basically a gift to that area, a gift to us all, actually. It's a great learning gift for me as I've observed it over the years, as what's worked, what doesn't work, what's invasive, what's taken over, what's really productive. And the food forest was critical in providing a lot of the fresh food to those families during COVID, and still is. And so where we're at now is there's some things that I will, it's going to be in its fifth year in August. This year it'll be 5 years. And it's in a very tough situation. It's overshadowed by the tall housing commission flats. There's wind tunnels that are created because the wind hits those and then comes around the corner and slams into the food forest. So some of those species have really struggled, but they've just produced, you know, they've just been producing, so productive. And nature is just so beautiful that if you support her and you work with her, there is such abundance, you know. And one of the other projects I'm in is Seed Savers, and we collect a lot of the seeds from the veni, from the food forest, and that becomes a seed bank. And then we swap, we package up those seeds and we put them in two seed boxes at the neighborhood house and one up at this Eastwood Street garden here, and people help themselves to those seeds. And they know that they are grown in chemical-free spaces, and we grow them out every year so that we maintain their viability and vitality. And then also they started from heirloom and heritage seeds. So we're also building up food security from those seeds. Also the food forest provides us as a nursery in terms of we can separate, apart from the seeds, but we can separate the roots, plants such as rhubarb, asparagus, we've got artichoke. So there's plants that we can harvest there from, the little saplings that grow, and they can be shared around other gardens. And we hopefully are going to get to a point where we can actually distribute that through a market or something with the food, so that we can, that can help us to sustain the ongoing farming that we're doing in those areas. We've built two propagation sheds, one near the food forest, and that will help us seed things, but also gather the seeds from the food forest, put them in, and then pass those on to the community. So the food forest is, it's amazing because I didn't know what would happen. I had a basic design, which I put in from what I'd learned in permaculture, but then the forest has its own life and its own evolution. And it moves in ways that I'm there to observe and go, oh, okay, is that a problem or not? And we have a threshold for weeds, because so-called weeds are actual pioneer plants, because they'll go into an environment where no other plant can succeed. And they've got sometimes deep tap roots, so they'll go down and break up compacted land, which allows water and nutrients to move more freely, so it becomes more available to other plants that can't do what the weed does. So weeds are used in permaculture and in forest gardening to actually be pioneer species to break things up and change, so the next succession of grasses and herbs can come in. So when you know that, you can use them and you can allow a threshold and go, okay, we let the weed do that. It's also capturing that nutrient, and then we'll chop it and drop it and put it there. And there's plants that in the food forest that have a pest repellent, or confuse the pest by having fragrance, so that, you know, we're using all those kind of understandings and teachings from very experienced people that's been passed down, either as food forest technology or companion planting or pest soil management, in a way that requires very minimal inputs from us and not much intervention. So everything goes back in there. There's not a truck that comes and picks up our green waste and takes it. We use the plants to create the tonics, like the comfrey makes a tea that we then distribute on, and that distributes nutrients. We're using, now that we've got a compost bay in the food forest, people are bringing down the organic food scraps, and that compost, once completed, will go into the food forest. So it will become a bit of a loop there on the estate, and hopefully more and more people from the estate will put more of their waste in, so that compost that's finished can be spread around all the estate gardens. And it's about not trucking in food, not trucking in compost, not trucking out waste, because all of that has a big carbon footprint and all of that is damaging to our planet. So it's about localizing the whole food system by using the resources to grow the food. Once they've eaten the food, they can put it back into the compost, We use that again on the food forest. The seeds are used to create more food. And that's the understanding and process of the food forest on that estate. And it evolves. It will evolve.
Amazing. So how big is actually the piece of land to get an idea?
Yeah, it's a very unusual shape. It's kind of like, I should have had a visual to show you. It's on one end of it, it's shaped like an L, but the L's in the middle of it. So it's shaped like an E with the two ends of the E not being there. I mean, I don't know, that's very confusing. So maybe a triangle or something. So it's about 20 meters on one side, 5 on one side, 8 meters on one side and 2 meters. It's a really unusual shape, but we're not talking about a big space.
Okay.
Yeah. And we've got about,
yeah,
we've got about 27 fruit producing trees, about 90 species of plants under story supporting. So there's quite a diversity.
Amazing. And this is next to the commission housing or
It's in between, it's at number 56 Derby Street, Kensington. So it's, and you, if you go to Google, you'll see it's actually marked the food forest. So it's in between a very high rise housing estate block and then a lower level one. And it sits there.
And so the different nationalities, so they, I assume they're really enjoying it because sometimes also feel they're much more connected still with gardening, a lot of those people compared to the Western white societies, if that's how I can word it, because I found often they really have a really good knowledge of gardening.
And then it's also about what species are appropriate, because we've got a lot of people from Eastern Africa. And so the climate that their food grows in is not the same, you know, is not really compatible to a temperate, cool temperate or climate that we have here. They're more like a dry, wet, and even a desert, kind of semi-desert. And their land has changed so much with degradation. So the species that they're growing, there's very few that transfer and translate. But then we've got Spanish people that have got, they've got a veggie pot. We've got people from Asia and they've brought a lot of their species in and they've grown a lot of food and they request things, you know. It's interesting because whilst there's this interest in food growing, they're very busy with their lives in terms of managing the experience they've just had, you know, in getting to this country. So there's a lot of that has to be worked through for them, you know, and because we would have liked them to be more involved in it, and some of them were, but it was really they've got all their children that they've got to manage, they've got their husbands they've got to look after, and this is all different, it's not a general view, but they've just got so much on their plate, that they haven't been able to be involved as much as I thought. And I get it. And we've had discussions about it with them and they come and they'll pick and they'll put a little plant in and they're very interested, you know. And so it's just interesting how when I'm in the food forest, the conversations that I have with people who come by, all sorts and what they will talk about. And that's the other great thing about the food forest is it allows that connection because you can talk about this plant or back home I was growing this or why I used to have that and that's the great gift of the forest to me when I'm in there is having these interactions with people that might normally not walk up to me and talk to me or wouldn't feel safe or comfortable and vice versa, you know, me would feel how do I approach this person. And so that's been a great learning for me and a great gift. And when I go down there now, most of my time is spent chatting to people. How are you going? You know, and I never get to do much of the work that I'd like to do, but it's all good, you know. And they'll let me know this was taken, this is not working. So they kind of let me know you know, their opinions. So also know then that they're watching it and they're observing it. Or they'll say, oh, those flowers, what's that? You know, there's a lady who's not well and she'll come and ask for various herbs that she takes and makes her teas and everything because that helps her. So the lemon balm helps her because lemon balm is really good tea for uplifting your spirits that's there. And I think we'd like to move into the next step of that where we educate or show people how they can use what's in the food forest for various ailments, build up their immunity, you know, and that would be the next thing. And it's free, so they go down and harvest it.
Yeah, it's amazing point of connection, definitely. And yeah, food, plants, and yeah, what you said, just having conversations. And it might be just also, yeah, pretty much connecting through the plant, talking through the plant, you know, not like about anything or everything, or maybe what they feel, or you know, what their problems are. It's just like a neutral space to have a conversation, which I think is amazing to also, for possibly a lot of people, to also help them to open up on different levels through having conversation through that. So let's say if I would like to make a food forest, because obviously forests, I imagine, like, you know, pine needle trees, big trees, and but obviously these ones are fruit trees. So as you said before, it's more like the concept of the layers of trees and different plants that grow underneath, and it all works together. So for like, how did you start? You said you had like this green grass there, to go back to the practical part. And so how did you do you start to just first of all just work on the land to prepare it for planting something, if you want to share some of that?
Sure. So first of all, kind of look at what are we trying to achieve, and then what is the land telling us, you know, because the land has got its own story. So, you know, for example, we look at what is the soil currently like. We knew the vegetation was just grass, soil underneath. We did pH tests, soil tests. We took some soil samples and sent it away to Macquarie to find out if there was heavy chemicals in there, which would be, you know, problematic because then we'd have to remove all that soil, you know, like such as lead or arsenic, what levels were in there. We also looked at where is it. So it's in a climate, the climate. And because of the particular site, which I mentioned with the tall buildings, there was shadow. Where does the shadow come? Where does the sun come in summer and winter? What is its arc over it? And mapped all those kind of things, you know, what birds were moving through, what, how did the wind move? So when all of that gets plotted on a map, which is like in a site analysis, which kind of gives me a view of what is what I can't change, what is got to be designed around. And then there's our objective where we want to create a lot of productive food, but we don't want it to be locked. We want it to be open. We don't want to spend a lot of money on inputs. We want it to get to a point where it meets minimum care and even start with that, you know. And that means then, you know, ongoingly, how do we look at managing the soil? How do we look at managing the pests? You know, what is the succession of the trees? And because we're talking about seven levels, so you've got your canopy and then you've got your mid-story, then you've got your herbs and then your ground covers, and how all of these going to work together, because architecturally each tree has got a different form above the ground and below the ground. It's got a different root system, and you want to make sure that they work together. One doesn't overshadow the other when they get bigger. And so there's so many factors that go into it. So you look at all of that, you bring what the site's telling you, what you want, what the plants want, and all of that then starts to kind of form a little map. So you map out the space and you start to get an idea of where things need to go, because you've mapped out where the sun is. So you know, okay, that gets lots of sun in summer. We need to be aware that there's plants there that we need to put, that we can handle that hot afternoon sun. This has got a long shadow, so potentially we can put, you know, trees and plants that need a long chilling period. So like European fruit trees, apples, would be great there, because that's going to be in shade a big part of the year, a long chilling period, but then it still does get sun. And then this bit here is more suitable to citrus because it gets sun most of the year, so we can put our citrus in there. And this is very windy. We need a windbreak. What trees will handle the wind? What do we put here to manage that? Then how do we support those trees in terms of pests, nutrients, and how do we make it that those plants can also have more than one function? In other words, they do that, but then they also provide us with food and ground covers. And so a lot of the thinking goes into that, and like also nutrients, we want food across the year. So what tree fruits in January, February, March, April, so that we plot it all so that we've got variety of species. So every month there is something that we can receive from the forest. That's a production. So those are all the factors. And then, okay, how do we manage soil? Because we don't want to be bringing in compost every year from outside. We don't have the budget for that. So we put in species that we could chop and drop that would then form nutrients and ground, you know, that would then become the soil life, would give, it would give food for the soil life. Because the critical thing is to keep the soil life there and to encourage the soil life. So we spread, the first year I spread a green manure, which exudes a number of sugars and so forth, which activates the soil life and attracts the soil life. So when you've got a good soil life, they do the work for us. So the main thing was to make sure that we had species and food for the soil life, all the microorganisms, and they have various layers. There's the ones that break all down, they've got like pincers and chewers, and then there's a level underneath that, then there's the bacteria, then there's all this. And I don't even know all the science, but all I know is I need to feed them, because if I feed them, they will keep the fertility of the soil going. And then it's at times like after heavy feeding, like now, put back into the soil. So it's about, okay, what do we do? How do we access that? It's not, you know, because once again, there's no money involved, and we don't want to be bringing in, you know, that kind of materials all the time, which have got a high carbon footprint. So it's about planning for all that in the design so that it's ongoing. There's species that just we use just to chop and drop, and they add nutrients. Comfrey is a great one. Then there's like just native violets who just cover the ground and they keep that happening. And then there's companion planting, which we use as well. And each tree kind of has its own guild, which support it. And that's, so that was all went into the design of it. And then it was, once we did that, it was about engaging the community and saying, okay, this is what is going on, and this is why. So they had an understanding. And we decided to go that way because trying to go, what do you all want to grow, is just crazy. There needed to be some kind of framework and understanding. So there was consultation where we brought them all and we explained what we were doing and why we were doing it. And then they could buy in and they could be participate in various phases of the project. So they could help with the soil testing. They could then help with putting in the trees and plants. And then they could become a volunteer to Kibia and the forest care team. And those were the opportunities that they could be involved in, and they nominated themselves or not. And we explained the philosophy about the food forest was a fair share. Take something for yourself, leave something for the plant, and leave something for somebody else. And we had little fair share signs around. We also then realized after the first year, people didn't know when to pick stuff. They were picking it too ripe. So we'd have signs which says, right, take now, not ready yet. And that's slowly changed as a food forest has changed and people have changed too. So it was important for us to also be able to interact with what we saw going on in the first year, just to educate and keep the interest going and keep the awareness going. And it's also about skills transferring. So people know it's for everybody. It's learning for everybody. And now and again, we'd find things planted in the food forest in a spare spot. And sometimes if the species would work, we'd leave it. And if it was going to be a problem later on, we'd remove it, you know. And we'd say, you know, people know that if they put it in, they'll come down and say to me, I'll put that there, is that okay? or sometimes they ask for permission, and that's fine, because we don't want to have that hierarchy where, you know, no, yes, no, we don't want that. So we're kind of saying to them in the beginning that if they understood all what we were doing, then they would think more than about before they put something in, because they knew that there was a systems thinking around stuff, and that each plant had a specific function and purpose in the whole system. And watering was another one. We knew that we wouldn't be able to build swales. I try to build swales where it would capture the water and sink it in as well, because we needed to build up the soil. So we did have drip line irrigation in the beginning because of the size of it. And we didn't have a full-time person gardener switching on and off. So the water is irrigated. And we'd come down for the first couple of years, we would do that manually. The forest care team workers would come down and put it on or switch it off, because we really wanted the roots to go deeper and for them to find the water and try not to rely on a drip line irrigation. But because of global warming, we're finding that particularly this summer, although our irrigation wasn't on for a while, we've had it fixed now to go on. You could see that the plants were struggling, but they were still surviving. And that's about building the robustness of them too. So, that part of the water thing I'm sitting with, how do I move forward now? We've built up the soil fertility really well, and the forest is going to have its own temperature. So it will be cooler as the canopy is getting bigger, and it's going to create its own little microclimate in there anyway. So we won't need to water it. Maybe we might need to water it once a week, if that. So there's the design, but as we did the design, we also need to think of what about year two, three, four, five down the track, you know, what is going to look like. Things will die off, the pioneer plants would die off, and what we're going to put in there to replace it. And as the canopy gets bigger, it'll shade over things, plants too. So a lot of that I'm allowing nature and the forest just to do its thing and see what arises. There's been a lot of self-seeding of plants, which is great, because that doesn't require us to do any work. And it's still vital, and there's not much pests. And so, yeah, a lot of it is just observing and seeing when to come in and intervene, or when to just watch and go, okay, let's see where this goes. But overall, it's thriving, it's growing, and there's a few problems that I would redesign differently. But overall, I think the amount of effort, I would say the outcomes if we've achieved, because no one's gone in there and done any work for 2 months and it's surviving. You know, so we'll do a bit of work now, just seasonal working bees, where we just, you know, chop down dead stuff, give it a bigger boost of worm juice, and then we'll look at it differently.
Yeah, that is great. So so pretty much did you just plan the whole out the whole design, or did you get some help as well?
I did the design myself, and that was able to be funded a bit by the grant, but most of the money went into the plants and the earthwork, just to shape some things, the pathways. And that's the other thing, like a lot of my energy went into it, and not all of it, you know, you don't get paid sometimes for this stuff, because it was bigger. It's something that's more important, and I'm not going to say I'm not going to do this because I'm not going to get the money that I should get for it. And it's given me so many other things, you know, so I never not do something because I'm not going to get paid for it or there's not enough money. In this kind of work, I found that there's no ads. Oh, can somebody create a food forest? You know, can somebody create a garden? It's kind of like when I'm inspired to move in a particular way, I'll move that way, and then things will happen to allow that to happen, because what I'm doing is not just for myself, it's for the greater good, it's for the planet and for the community. And I think a number of people I've met who've got something that they're passionate about and started a movement, to moved in that direction, things and people align and come behind them to support them to do it. And I've seen that so many times with some of these projects that I'm doing, that I just, that's how I operate now. I'm going, okay, I'm not waiting for someone to say, we want this to do person to do this on this land. I just see a bit of land, it goes, that needs love. We can do this. Let's get some money and it happens. And then hopefully people will see that too and go, oh, that's inspiring, you know? So putting the seed saving boxes around also is for to get people to think about it and go, oh, wow, okay, I can save my own seeds. I can use these seeds and plant some seeds, you know? And if people just reduce their reliance on the monoculture industrial farming system, it'll make such a difference. If everyone just grows a few of their own herbs, so they don't get go to the shop packet, buy the plastic packaged ones, which have taken 20 kilometers or not more by a truck with petrol, fossil fuel being used, you know, to deliver to the shop that's running in this, you know, the carbon footprint of the shop. And then you drive to the shop to get your, you know, if you had to look at all in how we buy things in terms of that, there's a big carbon footprint that's trailing behind. Whereas if you grow your own herbs, and no, you don't need herbs all the time. That's why in the food forest, we've got all the herbs that people need. And they can just help themselves. It's constant, it's there down at the doorstep. They can send the kids down, go get me some rosemary, go get me some this. You know. So I'm hoping that by people seeing food in the food forest and the seed saving boxes, that they will go, something I can do. This is different. I can do this. Hopefully it inspires somebody to go and do something that they love, which might be something else. But it is possible. And that's important, that people more see more and more how food can be grown in the city, how food can be grown in a small space. And once again, as we were talking about the Veni, connecting them to nature, connecting them back to their food source, where it comes from, how it can be different. And if we work on the soil fertility, that brings down a lot of carbon on the air. So keeping that soil fertile, apart from the plants and trees that will suck out the carbon, the soil, fertile soil does too. So that food forest is just is a carbon sink. And we haven't measured that. And also our compost hub bays that we've set up are carbon sink. Because by us processing that locally, there's a formula that's been worked out about how much carbon we are sinking through that process. So, you know, the last report that came out from the International Panel of Climate, IPCC, the two key points were we need to sink as much carbon as we can and we need to stop producing it as much. So those are the two mantras I'm basically using in the work that I'm doing around food and waste, is sinking it, not creating it.
Yeah, it's amazing because I think specifically bio-waste getting rid of in the normal bin, I think it produces a massive amount of gases in landfill, which is absolutely awful. I mean, finally, you can put your green waste now in the green bin, but I feel like composting is so much
easier. And when the City of Melbourne were bringing that out, because it was a director from the state government of Victoria, I wrote a paper, a transition town, we wrote a paper and we presented it to the council who were considering, and we were showing the footprint, the carbon footprint of that green bin is massive. It's massive. And we were saying, why aren't you supporting more of these compost hubs? You know, we worked it out, the compost hub committee worked it out that if we had 50 of these compost bins situated around Kensington, we could manage all the organic waste. So we presented the paper to say, and we met with the council, the people who were doing the rollout, to show them, you know, producing the plastic bins, first of all, another plastic bin to roll out. All the caddy liners that you have, the plastic liners, and I'm sorry, but the jury is still out around, people say plastic is biodegradable. The only thing that can be biodegradable is organic material. It goes back to nature. So, you know, like, and people I know have tried to put a plastic bag into the compost and it breaks down to little bits of plastic, but that still sits in the environment, you know, and how that goes, it's still waste. It's not like the natural system where everything that's organic just goes back into the into through entropy ends up in land and soil. So we provided, like, we had very strong conversations with them around, this is your choice. You know, this is what's actually going on. This is the carbon footprint of this. And you need to tell our community the whole story. You know, that you can be in a truck with all of this, and that truck is emitting so much, using fossil fuels that has taken so much to produce, is emitting it as it travels around 20, 30 Ks out. It's taking all our stuff 20, 30 Ks out to process in another factory, which is using fossil fuels to do it, and heavy machinery, which is full of fossil fuel, in the production of it. And you're trying to present that as that's a good thing. And this alternative here is people can compost their own at home, which is none of that. And the other alternatives, they can use a compost hub. So we were saying, present the whole picture, you know, because the truth around this one is not being told. And, you know, it's another big system where people think, oh, great, I'll dump it there, someone else's responsibility. But in that whole process, there's carbon emission, carbon emission, carbon emission, carbon emission, you know, and yes, people saying it's better than, but we got to move beyond that and really question, is this the best thing? When our planet really requires us at the moment to scrutinize every that we're emitting, is that the best that you can come up with? And it's the best that that system can come up with. I understand it, because they're used to having big contracts. They find it very difficult to work small. You know, they're used to, they are so good at outsourcing and signing a contract away to somebody. They can manage contracts. Managing small communities is different. They don't have the resources and they have a different focus. So, and that's because that's the system that's been devised and that we're part of. But what worries me is that the thinking isn't there. Like, there are all these other amazing things that have been done around the world through transition towns and people like that, where they're bringing everything back. How do we as a community, and COVID was a great example for that, you know, how as a community, how resilient are we if suddenly we can't get our food trucked into us, we can't get our waste trucked out, you know, if we don't get water pumped in and our excrement pumped out, what are we going to do? And we need to start moving to that transition so it's not a shock and chaos, but also so that it can give the earth a breather. And we can regenerate and go back to thinking about things that don't require all this fossil fuel and production, but it's simple and it's, you know, I'd like to see more of those discussions in council and just having that discussion with them around this green bin was just showing me their thinking was just in a different place than mine. And it was a great opportunity to speak to them, but still nothing was done. And I said, and here you are, and all you're wanting to know is, am I going to support what you're saying? You don't want me to go against what you're saying. You know? And I'm like, we need to tell the whole story. So we did. We did this Waste Wisdoms newsletter, which we've been doing at the housing estate to try and get people to think about waste and what they can do about it. And so it was a monthly newsletter that we distributed on the housing estate to get people to think about waste more, like what you're bringing in, think about what you're bringing in. And we followed the waste hierarchy and addressed each of those in an addition. And we addressed your options around your organic waste. And then, you know, this was very high carbon footprint. This was none. This was an alternative, just to get the people thinking. But I also realized that people don't really want to think sometimes. You know, when your life is so busy, you're trying to get to work 9 to 5, you want to buy your house, you want to get your mortgage, you want to get your kids to school. You become quite individualized and it just becomes about what you need. And you're so busy in that it's to take a step back and go, okay, what, I'm a part of the whole, you know, how am I going to be in the whole? What do I bring to the whole? What energy and thinking, when I leave my door, how am I impacting on the world? What is the energy I take with me? And, you know, how am I in service? And that's been part of my own personal journey in terms of what I was doing, exploring, understanding, connecting more, and where now my work is very different. But I've used the amazing skills that I did learn in the corporate world. So I know how to position things to government or argue or think or be strategic. And I think that's helped me greatly in getting projects like the Food Forest up, understanding all the stakeholders and what they need to be able to say yes and get the tick from their boss and so forth. So understanding the systems that are in place, and whilst I don't agree with them, but work with them and try shift them a bit more to, hey, can we look at it in a different way? You know, can we look at it in a holistic way where it's a collaborative way, it's more feminine way, and bringing in feminine principles to work instead of hierarchical, you know, dominant, male-dominated ways of looking at things, which is all will, whereas the feminine is more loving, more open, more receptive, more collaborative, not competitive. And how do we bring that sensitivity that we have to the mix, because both are important, but one, it's unbalanced. Our systems that are currently there are unbalanced, and it's about how to bring the feminine. And the question that a lot of people are asking, like myself, well, what is the feminine and how does that work with the current system? And that's when we need to have those discussions. So I've been exploring that the last few years as well, and that's led me to set up the women's circles that are running, where we can actually go and get the feminine to actually connect with that part and open that part to see what that feels like, and to identify and recognize, oh, wow, yes, that's missing. Or why is that missing? Well, because there's a wound or something, but blah, blah. And it's very different for it. And it's very different for each woman and each being, the wound. And most of us, I think at the moment, are operating from the wound in this world, which then creates more struggle and suffering. And you know, there's different thinking of, do you dive into the wound and unpack it, or do you recognize it and then go, okay, and I'm going to look for another one, and I'm going to go to love. I've got all this pain here and I feel it, and I'm going to go to some, and I'm going to go to the love. What do I love? I was asked that question last year in a program, and I was like, oh my God, what do I love? And I never thought of that before. And slowly through the year, what I love is going like this. And I go to that now instead of going to, oh, that's my wound. I've got to unpack my father relationship who did that, my, you know, trauma and that trauma and my inherited trauma. And I go to, okay, I know that's all in me. And what do I love? And I'm on this beautiful planet at this time. What am I bringing in service? Look at that beautiful tree that's giving me that amazing fruit. Look at that. Gratitude, gratitude, gratitude. And change my chemical biology. Change the way I am in myself and how I see and how I speak now. I'm noticing my language is different. My words are different because each word has its own vibration. And if I'm saying all the wound stuff and I'm this, I'm tired, you know, that's what I'm creating when I'm saying, oh, I love that tree, look at that, oh, isn't that beautiful, I love the sea, I love when I swim, I love the wind on my face, you know, I love, it takes me into a totally different world. And I know I've segued, I can't even remember what the question was. Sorry, Lena.
No, it's I think that we're really beautiful finishing words, because this is what it's all about, really, on like shifting the focus on gratitude and acceptance and what we love, and some things are not going to be able to change in the past, but we could make it a better one. And surround yourself with people that have the knowledge and can, you know, share those wisdom, and you might learn for the rest of the time you're here. Because I read the other day again, it's such a short time here. What we have, even if it might seems long for some, but it's definitely, even if you 80 years and you go through these different ages and stages, it's definitely a long time to discover a lot of things unless you do so and you make something out of it. Do you have your poem there you wanted to read? Or do you want me to read it?
I'll find it. I'm happy. It was so interesting because that poem has been sitting with me. It came from that thing of love, how would I want everybody to feel? What can I offer? You know, when you ask that question, what is your message? And it's a bit like a blessing that I think I'm happy to share it, but I'm also happy if you want it. How do you feel?
Yeah, you can share it if you. I just didn't know whether you had your phone there to find it.
I'll say, okay, this is a blessing for everyone. May the sun always warm you. May the wind blow gently on your face. May the river flow through you and in you. May grace meet you often on the road. May those who walk alongside you love and support you. May you have compassion for all you meet. May you return to the wild lands often. May you know what you love. May you remember your unique song and sing it to the world. Remember, you are the gift.
So nice. Thank you so much for your openness and sharing. And I will share your details in the show notes so people can contact you if they have more questions, or maybe if they want to get involved, or pretty much whatever you can share and people want to know, you guys can share with each other. Thank you so much, Jacqueline, for this hour of wisdom, I feel.
Thank you so much for creating this, Nina. Thank you for what you bring in down too. It's wonderful.
Thank you.